part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
So do I pronounce your name Joe Corallo, or is it Corallo, or?
You can just go Corallo, that's fine.
Corallo, okay, great. I see the double L, yeah. And I'm half Colombian, so it converts to, you know, the Latin pronunciation for me, but it's Joe Corallo.
Oh, yeah.
Excellent, cool. Well, let's just start off by saying that this is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. My name is Christian Horn. We have just pronounced your name correctly. We've gotten the pronunciation correctly. Joe Corallo is on the line, and you are on the line because, is this book out now, or is it, I'm always bad about that. Like, what is the release date on this? Is it in shops right now?
This will be out in less than 2 weeks from when we're recording.
Nice.
We're recording this on the 14th, and
yeah.
This will be out on the 23rd and 24th. I think bookstores, it's the 23rd, and comic shops, it's the 24th.
Got it. Oh, okay, cool. Mm-hmm. And the name of the book, well, it's King Arthur and the Knights of Justice, and it's by the Maverick imprint of Mad Cave Studios, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
You got it.
Nailed it. No, I love Mad Cave stuff. So I love, like, whenever their creators come on, because they have really great product. And I love, like, their whole thing of, like, subscription service and, you know, different things like that. So, yeah, I mean, they make it easy to get their books if you want them. So, yeah, they're a really great publishing company. So I'm happy to have you on. I'm happy to talk about this book. King Arthur and the Knights of Justice. So this was a cartoon show, right? At one point.
Yes, it was a cartoon from 93 to 94, 26 episodes. You can still watch, I believe, all of it's on Peacock, and I think
the first
season's on Tubi. Yeah.
Oh, I found it on YouTube. Oh, okay. That's interesting. I didn't
Yeah, I think it's also on there, but Tubi has the whole first season.
Yeah.
And the both seasons, I believe, are on Peacock.
Got it. So this is interesting because I, you know, as a nerd, I kind of consider myself a bit of an aficionado on cartoon shows and stuff like that. But since this is like 92, 93 or around that time, I may have been like in my early, like late teens, early 20s. So not have been the audience for this particular show when it debuted. So it's always
That's
interesting.
Fair.
Yeah. Well, it's always interesting to me when I come across a cartoon show that I didn't really know existed. So like, I was like, okay, what is this? Let me find out about it. And, I should say that you did a really good job reading having read the book and having seen a couple episodes on YouTube. Sorry, Peacock. Sorry, Tubi. Everyone should get money for, you know, watching the streams. But, you did a really good job of like encapsulating the old show, or at least the first couple episodes, like the first episode that I happened to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Were you a fan of this show before, like, you were, you worked on this property?
Oh yeah, no. I watched this as a kid.
Okay.
Because I would have been, you know, around 8, 9 years old when this was coming out, and I also want to thank you for being too old to have watched the show at the time, because my time's coming up on that. I'm not going to hear that too much in the coming years. Like it's a small window.
Yeah.
And I appreciate you. You know, being in that position for me, because before I know it, I'm going to be, you know, the guy who is just like, yeah, I was too old. You know?
Well,
so,
I think,
so thank you.
Well, there's this funny window, right? Between like, I want to say like the Dungeons and Dragons, like cartoon show or something like that,
sure.
Or like G.I. Joe and Transformers, and then Batman, the animated series, which made everyone go like, what the fuck? Like they really did like an amazing job with, which I'm actually rewatching the whole series, the Batman animated show, like right now on Blu-ray. But nice. Yeah. I felt like revisiting it out of the blue. And I was like, well, I have these. I should probably watch them. They've been sitting in my cabinet for, you know, and, but there is this funny window for like people around my age. I won't say my age. Yeah. You can figure it out. Do the math maybe. I'm a child of the 80s, but there's this window where it's like, there's a bunch of cartoon shows that existed that I didn't know existed and have this fan base that is apparently pretty like into, you know, when I did research on the show and I looked up some of the reviews, like on the Internet Movie Database and stuff, there were all these there were several people who were like, this show was the bomb. And like, I loved this show as a kid and all that stuff. And I was like, I didn't even know this existed. So it sounds like you were in the age range of that crowd that like came across it and watched it.
No, I absolutely was. And now to break format a little bit, I want to ask you a question. What is an obscure cartoon that you watched as a kid that you don't think people remember?
I can absolutely answer this 100%. And I think it's one of the greatest Saturday morning cartoon shows that did not get enough recognition. And I actually have it on DVD. It's called Mighty Orbots. Do you remember the Mighty Orbots?
I do vaguely remember that.
It's so good.
You know, I've seen so many things. I will look it up after this and make sure I watch it up, because I watch so many obscure, cartoons or cartoons before my time. Not as often after my time, a little bit, but I mostly stick to stuff from like my time and earlier. But I mean, it's crazy. It was really during, I think, like lockdown. I had actually rewatched episodes of King Arthur and the Knights of Justice like before lockdown and all that stuff. Because I would find them streaming different places or like YouTube, like you said. And
I
actually showed it to a friend of mine, Chase, a few years ago. We watched like the first couple of episodes and all that, because I was like, I used to watch the show as a kid. I got to show you. But there is now this whole phenomenon of different, you know, I usually use YouTube, but I mean, Twitch and other places that people upload recreations of entire Saturday morning cartoon blocks from different channels, different years, different eras.
Really?
And
like, what do you mean recreation? Crazy. What does that mean? Like, what did they recreate episodes?
Like, it's the original block or whatever they could get in terms of, you know, like sometimes you can't upload certain things because of like copyright and all that. Like, they'll be like, it's Fox Kids 1993.
Gotcha. Where it's like the block of programming.
It's the block of programming with bumpers,
commercials,
commercials.
Yeah.
Everything. And
it's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, so I do that, and also they do weekday morning shows, like all different sort of blocks. I noticed there's been some more Saturday anime, because Sci-Fi Channel used to do that. That's how I really got into anime. I mean, I watched Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball and then Dragon Ball Z as a kid. But in terms of like more mature anime, Saturday anime on Sci-Fi really got me into that, with like Lily Cat and Eight Man After and Iria and Record of Lodoss War.
Record of Lodoss War. I've actually got, that's another one I have on Blu-ray, and I need to like stick in and watch it, rewatch at some point.
It's really good.
Yeah, it is really good. No, that's interesting that you mentioned, I came across one of those blocks of programming. You probably won't remember this show, but it was called Solid Gold. And it was like a top 10 countdown every week. And I came across like a New Year's block where it was like the New Year's special. And it was like 1984 or 85 or whatever. And it was like all this like top 80s. And, you know, they're dressed in like a tuxedo with like glitter and sparkles and the solid gold. It was amazing. I was like, wow, somebody uploaded this whole block. I was just like, I was melting from the nostalgic overload. It was like really, really cheesy and really fun. But that's great that you were into this show. I mean, that's one of the things so I'm very curious about how you became involved with this project, because I know that like Mad Cave, I think that they do things a little bit differently with creators, where sometimes they will approach a creator, or sometimes they will have a property or an idea that they want to develop with someone, and they will go, hey, we have this thing, do you want to develop it with us? How did you get pulled into working on this project with Mad Cave? Because I would imagine that Mad Cave went and got the rights to the show, and then...
Yeah. Yeah, so they through, 41 Entertainment.
Yeah.
This was a package. It was part of, because it was King Arthur and the Knights of Justice and Princess Guinevere and the Jewel Riders.
Oh.
And this all sort of happened, like, I was not watching Princess Guinevere and the Jewel Riders. However, this was Baltimore Comic-Con 2022.
Okay.
At this point, I had more or less finished my writing duties on Die in the Dark.
Okay.
Which came out in the first issue came out in December.
Got it.
Of 2022.
Okay.
So I talked to Chaz over there at Mad Cave at Baltimore Comic-Con, being like, if anything else is, coming up, I love, working on Beckstar. I did a story for Lower Your Sights. I got to do Dolly in the Dark. So I was like, hey, I like working with you guys. If there's anything else coming up, I'd be happy to throw my hat in the ring. Because I understand, it's not like, I'm not, privileged to things. I got to, throw my hat in the ring just like anybody else.
Sure.
So, I was like, and then... he was like, have you ever heard of this show, like Princess Guinevere and the Jewel Riders? And I was like, I never watched that.
I haven't even heard of that show.
Yeah, it's worth checking out just to be like, we talked about it, I watched a couple of episodes just to, out of curiosity.
Yeah.
And I kind of remembered some of it. Like it was. It was definitely nothing I like actively watch, but I think there were times, it could have been on the background, or, you're just flipping through the channels, or like, you're a kid and you're like, oh, well, the cartoon's on. So sure.
Sure. Sure.
I was like, I never watched that, but I used to watch King Arthur and the Knights of Justice, like said the full title. Like,
oh, really?
And all that. I'm like, I used to watch the show King Arthur and the Knights of Justice. And it was more or less like, interesting. We might talk then about
that
sort of thing. And it worked out that, they were figuring that out. They wanted to do the book. They were casting it. And, they recruited me as the writer. And I got to work, closely with Lauren, my editor on it, who more or less had a rough outline of sort of the like major points that wanted to occur in this book.
Got it.
Once they established that, they brought in a writer, me, and I elaborated on that. I did page breakdowns. I scripted it all out, it was a fun, crazy time. I got to rewatch the show.
Oh, wow.
I got
to rewatch every episode.
I didn't have to. No one asked me to.
Oh, okay.
But,
it's just due diligence, right?
Yeah. I think due diligence is important. It's interesting, too, because Grant Morrison put out that novel Luda that I read right around this time. And it also is heavily influenced by Arthurian myth.
Okay.
So there's a little bit of elements from that I incorporated. I'm a big fan of the John Borman film Excalibur.
Oh, hell yes. Yeah.
So I definitely leaned into a bit of that, especially with sort of like elevating Merlin and Morgana's rivalry.
Sure.
I really wanted to exploit that and do some really over the top stuff. So, Helen Mirren. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Excalibur, in my opinion, is what George Lucas should have looked at for the prequels to the Star Wars.
Yeah.
He should have looked at that and been like, because I mean, that's all it kind of was from the beginning, right? Like that backstory. And I'm just like, why didn't you do more of the, like, you know, the sort of beauty of it and the groundedness of it and everything. And, you know, whatever you want to say about the prequels, I'm not going to bash them again. I've done it, you know, but like, Excalibur is a gorgeous film. Oh, wow. Nice.
And then I have a very nice copy of Le Morte d'Arthur that I also drew some inspiration from.
People can't see it, but you're showing it to me. Yeah, it looks gorgeous.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, it's all, like, important stuff. And, I mean, like, I've just always been a fan of Arthurian myth. I mean, if you're a kid, I mean, that stuff, it's cool.
Yeah.
You know, and then as you get older, like, it's still cool stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I really, you know, just enjoy it. I was into that kind of stuff and that lore before I got into, you know, like Dungeons and Dragons and things.
Okay. Yeah, for me, I might have been the other way around, where I was introduced to Dungeons and Dragons and playing role-playing games, and then I kind of like, and I think Excalibur might have been out, you know, VHS, you know, at the time I was a kid, or on cable or something. And but yeah. No, I was hardcore into that stuff for a long time. And so I get where you're coming from. Like, that's one of the things that was interesting to me about your adaptation, right? Is that, because I did watch the first episode, and in the first episode of the series, like, Arthur and his knights have already kind of been, like, banished, like, taken care of. And I guess it's for expediency of the story. And I had read the first chunk of your book before I checked out the series, and I was like, oh wait, like, they totally kind of got rid of that part. And I found it, you know, it was cool that you is this considered a sequel, like a relaunch, or I'm not quite sure how to, what would you,
this is, I would say this is like a
reimagining,
like a reboot.
Got it.
You know, like a an update, because this is basically, you know, it's very similar to events that take place in the show, but it's also, you know, it's our own thing. It's aged up a little bit. Like, it's a more violent, like, we get a little more violent, a little more heavy, a little more dark than the cartoon gets.
Yeah. No, I mean that, but it's interesting that you showed more stuff than the actual cartoon did. And I kind of like appreciated that, because I was like, oh, cause like in the cartoon, and, you know, not to disparage it in any way, it was just like, okay, like, what happened to, you know, what exactly happened? And maybe they address it in later episodes, or, you know, but I was just like, oh, we didn't get into that at all. And the other thing I kind of wanted to ask you about, I mean, it's an interesting premise. We haven't really talked about, like, I'm sure there's fans of the show out there that might be listening to it, but what is King Arthur and the Knights of Justice about? Because, I mean, it is an inherently, like, goofy Saturday morning cartoon premise.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Where it's like, so do you want to explain to people, like, what the sort of, like, basic premise of the show is about?
The book, and it's similar to the show, of course, but it's you know, the King Arthur and his Knights of Justice, which are the Knights of the Round Table, you know, more or less are they finally lose to Morgana and her knights.
Gotcha.
So Merlin has to find replacements to sort of, you know, carry the mantle and help him defeat Morgana.
Yeah.
So he goes, he ends up in, you know, present day and finds these, this football team, because he because he needs a group of people. It's like 12 men that can act as one. It's this whole thing of sort of like, you need a team with cohesion that can, you know, work together so they can, you know, defeat Morgana.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a way to sort of, it's like they're all Han Solos in a way. Cause like the whole point of Han Solo is to be the character that the audience can more directly relate to. Who's like, he's the guy who's doing all the stuff like, what's going on here? The Force, what's that? Like,
yeah.
So you need these characters who can kind of be like, what's happening? What's going on? So you have that, and then they have to liberate the original King Arthur and his knights from Morgana, and you know, then they can go back home. And that's more or less the cartoon as well as the book. But yeah, it's, you know, there's these little sort of changes, like Morgana is, you know, she has her warlords. It's like a mix of like, there's like, you know, Lord Viper, who's like a living person. And then there's these other warlords who are, you know, like basically animated suits of armor, more or less. Which, you know, I mean, this is a very 90s cartoon sort of thing, right? Because you can get around violence if, you know, you can have, you know, Raph stabbing members of the Foot Clan as long as they're robots.
Yeah. Or people can shoot each other in a cartoon as long as it's just with blasters and not actual guns.
It's all that same thing. So that's kind of like something that's built into it. But you know, so here we do get to be a little more violent. There's a little bit of, you know, blood, but it's, I think it's pretty tasteful. I reference in the script, because I'm also a big X-Men fan, there's a couple of moments in there where it's like silhouetted with a red background.
Yeah.
And I'm referencing that one issue of X-Men during the Phoenix Saga where Wolverine just goes all out against the Hellfire Club.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I was thinking of for that stuff. I was like, oh, it's got to be like this. And that's, you know, sort of how we did that.
Yeah, like Wolverine alone, like that. I think that was the title of the issue. Yeah. No, that's great. No, I mean, it's the sort of like, you know, and I used the word goofy before, but it, I mean, it works for kids or teenagers who are like watching it. Course you would get a football team to come back and be like, you know, the Knights of the Round Table and, you know, the sort of like themes of like teamwork and brotherhood and all that, like, and their team is called the Knights, correct? Like their football team and stuff.
Yeah.
So it works perfectly. Yeah. They fit right in. But as far as like bringing it into sort of the modern, you know, world or taking an adaptation into, you know, 2024, something like 30 whatever years later, what were some of the things that you wanted to do with it? Because when I was watching the animated show, I mean, it's interesting. They did sort of have, they had a couple of like African American characters and they had, you know, an Asian character for sure. I noticed that you didn't, necessarily change any of the, like gender swap any of the characters or something that a creator might, you know, creators have done in the recent past where it's like, oh, it's a team of 12 men. Why not a female? Why not? You know what I'm saying? So any thoughts as to that?
Yeah. I mean, for this, you know, we wanted to keep, you know, I think we all wanted to keep as close to the show as possible.
Sure.
You know, we do add a queer element with, you know, Lance and Bree sort of being in, not sort of, they are in a relationship.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we have that, but I mean, a lot of other things in this would have required, like, if you change one thing, you then have to change other elements of it, and it, you know, can get tricky. Whereas it's instead of just, you know, doing the show straight. Part of this too, I think, is, you know, we do have Princess Guinevere and the Jewel Riders, which is, you know, like sort of adjacent to this book, which is a female heavy story. So it's not, you know, so this is, you know, there's definitely more, you know, men in this story.
Yeah.
If you start changing, then it's like, then you'd probably be having to do two different sports teams. And like, you start getting like, you know, a little in the weeds unnecessarily. And also the story itself has three very strong and powerful women in Morgana, the Lady of the Table, and, you know, Guinevere anyway.
Yeah.
So, and they have, they, all of them, you know, especially Morgana and Guinevere have, a pretty large role throughout the story. Additionally, you know, we did make some changes. You know, I opted to do certain things with like Guinevere and how she's treated and what she does. That's a little different from the show. Again, not to criticize the show,
yeah,
but you know, just to give it a little bit of a different angle. Like in the show, and again, this is also in part because a cartoon like that is designed to run as long as possible.
Sure.
You want to get it syndicated. In a perfect world, you want like 100+ episodes of this cartoon.
Okay.
You know, and it did get 2 full seasons, 26 episodes, but like Guinevere doesn't quite get, you know, they don't really explain to her that they're not the real, like she's like kind of suspicious, but like they're real, it's a real slow burn with that, because if you're doing a long form show, you want to have things sort of in your back pocket to like, you know, throw around later on.
Got it. So in the show, is that like the, like Superman, Lois Lane sort of thing? Like what is going on with my husband? Or like they drag that out on the show?
Yeah.
Got it.
It's dragged out more in the show. So here, since it's, you know, different format, you know, we really wanted to tell the story in, you know, a book.
Yeah.
We have Guinevere being, you know, more intuitive here, being very quick to sort of be like, there's something off here. So in a way, that's also kind of elevating Guinevere. She's definitely someone who has agency. She's not exactly a damsel in distress. Like there are moments that are, you know, sort of tense and potentially frightening.
Sure.
That involve Guinevere, but there's nothing in this book that's like, oh no, Morgana has abducted Guinevere and we have to go up the tower and save her. Like there's nothing like that.
Yeah.
She does face danger, but yeah, so we don't do that. So I think that there is that element to it. And again, like you were pointing out before, there was a lot of sort of diversity already baked into this story. So it also feels like, well, you know, what point, you know, like what like me as a writer taking on a project like this, it's like, I don't feel like it's my place to be looking for these different things to change about the show.
Yeah.
Especially when they did get a bunch of things, you know, like in a way you could argue that, you know, they were ahead of their time in having a more, you know, sort of diverse, you know, male cast for the team. So.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. They were trying. Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. They were. Yeah. I mean, like, everyone was, I mean, that's one of the things that I liked about it too. Wait, so Princess Guinevere and the Gem, was that like a spinoff of this or like a, is it tangential? Like, were they in relation to each other or like?
It's a little looser. It's, I guess the way, I think an interesting way to describe this is, so like Neil Gaiman used to describe like Vertigo.
Yeah.
As, you used to have to take like, early Vertigo when or like Sandman, I believe the way he described it, and I may be misquoting slightly, was Sandman before it went to Vertigo, when it was a main DC title, it was like you were taking a bus to the main DC universe. Like it wasn't that far, but it was still a hassle, and you would get, you know, some of these other characters like Martian Manhunter or whatever showing up.
Sure.
Then once it went to Vertigo, it was more like if you wanted to get to the main DC universe, you had to take a plane.
Got it. Yeah.
So I would say like King Arthur and Princess Guinevere and the Jewel Riders, they're, you have to take a plane. Like completely, well, like, yeah, there's some connective tissue, but it's not the same as like, you know, Cheers and Frasier, you know,
sure.
It's a little different.
I'm totally going to have to look up this Princess Guinevere show because I've never heard of it, but like visually, are they like stylistically kind of similar? Like,
I mean, it's, they were, the character designs and a lot of that stuff are different. Yeah, they're going for a different audience. I mean, you're still dealing with, like Merlin and characters like that.
Got it. Oh, okay. Cool. Yeah, again, that is a show that I had never heard of like before. So, but that I know one of the things I found interesting about this, and I'm curious to how you worked like with this as a writer, is basically like the premise is Merlin finds a football team and uses them to sort of like step in for King Arthur and his knights. And when I first was reading the book, and then when I watched, you know, the episode of the I guess the pilot or the original episode of the show, like there was a part of me that's like, oh, is this going to be like King Arthur in the present time? Like, you know, I was like, oh, is it, is he's, because I mean, part of what happens, I think, in your adaptation that doesn't happen in the show is that like Merlin becomes trapped in like a tree or something like that, correct?
Yeah.
And
That's more from myth. Yeah.
sure. And no, but I was like, oh, is that tree going to be around like hundreds of years later or whatever? But it's, that's not what happens. What happens is the players kind of get transported back in time. And then to me, I was like, oh, are they in the bodies or do they just look like, you know, because that was, and then that was also the thing that I really enjoyed too, is that Guinevere was like, yeah, something's not right here. And I was like, yeah, something better not be right. Because I'm like, all of a sudden this guy who's in King Arthur or looks like King Arthur, who's a football player from the future, is going to have to figure out how to deal with, you know, King Arthur's wife. So I liked the way that like everything kind of came together or the way that you put it together. But at the same time, I was like a little bit like, wait, they look like King Arthur, but they're not. So can you explain that a little bit to me or like walk through that or like how you work through that as a
Sure.
writer?
I mean, there are some elements to this that are like suspension of disbelief, right?
Sure.
So
Oh,
like
of course.
the show itself, yeah, that's exactly it. They look the same and they're transported and we don't really explain it beyond then. Beyond that, I mean, there's already so much going on in
Yeah.
terms of like the conceit of the show and the book
Yeah.
to follow. So like, I briefly thought of like, oh, I could like add some element of like, and then Merlin uses his glamour to make them all look slightly different so they fit in there. And like, maybe he did,
Yeah.
but to then like go on further to explain that just seemed like at some point it's like how much exposition versus how much people punching each other and hitting each other with swords, you
Yeah,
know.
yeah,
And
yeah.
at some point it's like that I wanted as much action and violence packed into this book as I possibly could get. And there were
That's
elements of
great.
that,
Yeah.
thank you, yeah, where it's like, well, you know, at some point it's like, okay, well, what are you gonna do? I mean, sure, is it a little silly that Lance has that same haircut in the present as he does in,
Yeah.
Camelot times? Absolutely. But you know, at some point it's like, oh, whatever. You just gotta like roll with it.
Yeah,
So
yeah.
that's that. Those were the kind of decisions where it was like, all right, do we really want to bore people by explaining every little detail and how this works, or do we want to have some fun?
Well, one thing I wanted to address too is your artist did a great job. Is
Sure.
it Gaia Cardinale? Is that correct?
Right now, yeah.
Cardinale. Yeah, did a great job of sort of, you know, for the, I mean, is it pencils and colors? Is it line work and colors that they did?
Yeah, they did the line work and the pencils and
Yeah,
stuff.
I mean,
The
real.
pencils, inks, and the colors, yeah.
I mean, it really, I mean, I loved how it captures the sort of spirit of the original show. Like, and I loved how it was very much like animated kind of like artwork where it's like line work and then colors, you know what I'm saying? Like kind of like not simple line work. I don't want to disparage it. That's not, but and also the flow of the pages and everything was like really nicely done. So I just wanted to call that out. I did not want to not giving them any credit in this episode of the show, but did a really great job. But one of the things I wanted to ask you was, how much leeway did both of you have as far as like taking elements of the old show and maybe updating them or upgrading them, changing designs, any of that stuff? Or were you more interested in just sort of like sticking with what came before and sticking with those designs so that they would remain familiar to like fans of the show?
I think we all were trying to stick to the original designs and conceit as much as possible, because we were updating certain things. And,
sure.
And it was sort of striking that balance of, okay, well, if we're going to update this, that, and the other thing, we really got to make sure we're keeping on top of certain things. We're still keeping the designs, you know, like toyetic or something like that, you know.
Because, yeah.
You know, the licensor, like, I have no idea. I haven't discussed this with them, but like, who knows? They might want to do an updated toy line or, you know, or a game or whatever. I don't know. That's not, you know, in my purview, but, you know, so you want to kind of stick to, you know, the designs that pop that people, you know, were interested in, you know, at the time, which we more or less do. There's some slight tweaks to certain things, but other than that, another thing that was I was actively doing when writing this was avoiding the use of cell phones.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Yeah.
Because I just feel like we're now at a point. Not to sound like old man yells at clouds over here.
Oh, I hear you.
But you know, it's I feel like way too many. You know, I'm not trying to call people. I get it. I'm not criticizing other people's work, but I feel that cell phones in comics are like so overdone and oversaturated at this point. If I didn't have to use them, I'd rather do that. So we more or less avoid that, because it's also not as engaging. Like, to me, as a reader, to just see page after page or panel after panel of texting on a cell phone, I think there was a novelty to it. I certainly thought there was a novelty to it years ago when people were first starting to do it. But at this point, I'm like, enough, come on.
Yeah.
So that was also something I was actively working on not putting in this. But I feel like in other stories, if it comes to it, you know, I'm not just talking about King Arthur, but, you know, like other things, you know, I do. If I can avoid it, great, you know?
Well, that's interesting to me, because would you say that the modern part of this show, I mean, again, the show premiered in 92, 93. I hadn't thought about it, but now that you're bringing it up, and now with like stuff like X-Men 97 and things like that, which supposedly, you know, takes place when that original run of that show ended. Yeah. Would you say that the modern equivalent of like the King Arthur, you know, the football player part, takes place in like 92, 93, like, you know, not cell phones, not, because there's none of that in here, and there's nothing that really necessarily distinguishes it as being in 2024, at least in my memory of reading it. Would you say that this is, you know, now that we're entering the 90s nostalgia period of like pop culture, you know, we've passed through Stranger Things and now we're moving on to the 90s. Yeah. Would you say that may have been in your mind, like, this takes place in the 90s?
I definitely, with this, I do think that it is more or less current day. However, I didn't feel the need to really press that, you know? I like, just as there are no cell phones, people aren't talking about how things are off the chain or wickety whack.
You know? For shizzle.
So So it's a little like it's a little nebulous in terms of that, which, you know, is perfectly fine with. I wanted to write something that has maybe, you know, a little more staying power. It doesn't feel too dated out the gate. So I think, like, for me, it was more trying to create something that's a little more evergreen than, is this 90s? Is this 2022, 2023, or 2024? Nobody's, they're not arguing about, how much Taylor Swift tickets cost. There's none of that.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't date it either. I mean, that's part of the thing is that, obviously the show has a look to it, which is very indicative of like shows of that time period. Right. Oh. And which is great. Oh, yeah. I love, I actually miss that in a lot of like, animated shows, today, but it also sort of like makes it flexible. But there's also sort of like a charm to like, hey, maybe this isn't not. Now you've put that in my brain where I'm like, okay, in my mind, this is in the 90s. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, but I think it's smart to avoid all that sort of thing because I mean I know that there's like a lot of horror movie directors, writers, and stuff like that who love to make their, now it seems like everything's like an 80s, period piece because there were no cell phones. There were no instant methods of communication. There were, that sort of thing. But I mean, I'm assuming that if they get transported to King Arthur times, they wouldn't have been able to take their cell phones with them anyway, right? So it doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, how much page real estate, like, do I want another action scene or do I want two pages of people being like, I can't call my best friend. Our phones don't work. Mine doesn't work either. Yeah. I don't get any reception. It's like, is that really exciting to read?
I know. So. Yeah, definitely not exciting to read. So I guess when you are handed a property like this, how gentle do you have to be with it? I mean, obviously you made a little bit of changes, but... And again, I'm coming from a place of ignorance regarding this show. And again, that's not disparaging the show. I just didn't know that it existed. I was older. Like I said, I'm an old man. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's like, how gentle do you have to be when you're doing a reboot of this sort of thing? You know, obviously we talked about some things that you avoided doing and some other things that you've interjected. But did your scripts have to go to the people that own the company that owns the property? Did you have to get approval, like that sort of thing?
Oh yeah. So I would write a script. I would write it in chunks.
Got it.
Cause it's a lot easier, to do something like 20 page chunks, send it in, get notes, from Lauren, my editor, get it to where we want it to be to present to the licensor and then get the approval from the licensor. And, the licensor, like, honestly, was really easy to work with. I think a lot of that also comes from getting the initial outline approved first, then getting the page breakdowns approved. So all that stuff makes it easier. So then once you're scripting, it's little things like being like, oh, well, maybe we could adjust this dialogue or like, oh, this or that. And it's nothing major because you already got the basic plot approved and then you got the pacing and the breakdown of the events approved.
Yeah.
So then it makes it a lot easier. So it was really easy working with them. The last thing you want to do is spend a few months writing like a 124 page comic script to then get a ton of notes and having to do rewrites and stuff like that. It's better for everyone to do it in smaller chunks. So that way you can, address these certain things and avoid a serious headache. But honestly, they were very easy to work with. And Lauren was also, a pleasure to work with, very easy to work with. And all of her notes were always to the benefit of the property. It would be like, maybe could we work in a line for like this character or something like that? Make sure we're addressing, because it's a large cast. I mean, the team alone is 12. Then you have Merlin, Guinevere, Lady Elaine, and Count Ainsworth. So we're at 16. And then you have Lord Viper, Morgana. So you're at like 18 fairly important characters to the story.
Yeah.
it's a lot of people to juggle. And then there's the other warlords, there's the squires, there's a, you know, handful of other people that have like a line or two throughout the book. So, you know, it's a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was one of the things that I was curious about. How did you balance, you know, there's like 12 knights, right? And then the other thing is, you know, kind of in relation to what I just asked, for you as a fan of the show, like how, you know, are you the type of writer that is more like, okay, I want to go in and change everything and then have to pull yourself back? Or, you know, how much in your brain, you know, because I mean, there's people that are going to make like, let's use Superman as an example and just be like, okay, we're just going to, he's not going to be like truth justice in the America. You know what I'm saying? Or he's going to be like more dark and he's going to snap people's necks. You know what I mean? And then there's other people who are like, no, I want to keep the underpants and, you know, I want him to be like, so for you coming at it as somebody who watched the show as a kid, and I don't know in your own personal, you know, rank of cartoon shows, whether it was huge for you or just like something that you watched, for you, how did you approach it? Like, how did you want to break everything? Did you want to change everything? Like that, what was your procedure for this as a fan of it?
Of course, I approach things like, especially from like a licensor of, you know, respect for the property, and, you know, letting the licensors sort of lead with that sort of stuff. You know, are you, if they are looking for a complete and total reimagining, I can do that. If they're looking to keep it close to the original, I can do that. I naturally lean more towards, you know, sort of the latter and keeping it close. You know, while adding maybe some of my own little touches to it. But I sort of have, you know, this, I default to a reverence for, you know, the properties themselves and doing the property as originally intended. Right.
Yeah.
So for something like this, I went through the show again. I dove into some Arthurian myth. If anything, doing this, I was looking at, if I was adding anything, it was in the vein of adding more from Arthurian myth than like, oh, I want to change this to make this align more with, you know, something I'm personally interested in more, or this and that, or I want to, you know, highlight this or that sort of thing. It's less that and more, oh, well, you know, Merlin being trapped in the tree, like thinking about like, oh, well,
sure,
these different elements of Arthurian mythology weren't really touched on. Maybe I can do that. Or, you know, I play with the relationship between Merlin and Morgana differently here. It's a little closer to probably Excalibur than the original show, where you know, Morgana here is very much, you know, the disciple of Merlin who has gone astray, and which isn't really in the show originally, but this is more of a, I was like, I want to do that. I wanted to, you know, it's also, I guess, a little Star Warsy, a little like Obi-Wan Vader kind of thing going too.
Sure. So. Well, of course. I mean, Star Wars took from, you know, I mean, it's not like Star Wars came fully for, like, was the original thing that everyone, you know what I'm saying? Like, attributed.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's, so, but like, when you got the assignment, were you a big enough fan of the show that you were like, yeah, like, fuck yeah. Like, I got King Arthur.
Oh, like, absolutely. Yeah.
That's great. That's terrific. That's great. So as far as this release, this is a graphic novel, correct? Like, this is a, it's pretty much like one and done.
Yeah. I mean, it's, in the vein of these sort of things, it's, you're getting a complete story with beginning, middle, and end, but there's also room for more if sales or other things sort of dictate. So, you know, just left that little bit open to be like, oh, well, maybe there's some more you can do here. So
gotcha.
We'll see.
And if you are the one who continues to write? Because I would assume that they would go back to you, like, if this is successful. Are there things in your brain? Are there things in your mind, like, now that you've written? I mean, this is like how many pages of story? It's over like 120 or something.
It's 124 pages of story, and the book itself has, just like a couple of extras, like in the back, some concept art and things like that.
Sure. I would imagine that in your mind, there are more things that you think you would want to do with the characters. And if you do have things that you want to do, would it depart greatly from what's been done before on the show? Like going forward for you or for the licensor, you are the licensee. Mad Cave is the licensee. They are the licensor. I know how it works. Mm-hmm. Like, how much of a departure do you think it would have to take from the original show to move forward?
At this point, it would, because we cover so much of, so much ground in the book that would have encompassed, the first couple of seasons of the show. If there was going to be more story-wise, not character-wise, for the most part, but story-wise, it would have to be a pretty big departure if more were to be done.
Oh, wow.
I think I don't want to spoil anything, but, there's some things that could be done that also align with, some of the events in the first couple of seasons. But to get, I feel like the pacing of this, the stuff that gets accomplished here, it would probably have to start departing a bit more from the show, certainly more significantly than this first volume.
Sure. Oh, that's great. I mean, that's kind of like a good tease. Is there a pitch that you have waiting, or have they gone back to you and been like, hey, we really love what you did? Like, is it all dependent on sales figures?
I mean, it's dependent on, the two big things are sales figures and, licensors' interest.
Sure.
I mean, if they're not interested, it doesn't happen. License you to do another book. But sales figures for sure are an important part of that. I certainly know at least some of what I would do if the story continues. I think most writers always, kind of have an idea of if I got to do more with this, I'd do that.
Sure.
I know exactly what I would do, for example, if I had more of, She Said Destroy with Vault, or if I had more, Beckstar. I know exactly what happens to Beckstar after the events in the book, I also do with Mad Cave. So again, it's an issue of if there's an opportunity, yes. And I already have the foundational idea of this is where I would start. And then if there's ever interest, then I'm I already kind of know where I'm starting. So it'll be easier to dive in and flesh something out if it comes to that. But, you can't linger on that too much and get your hopes up for certain things because, you don't want to dive too much of your time and energy into a hypothetical. You want to do enough so you're ready just in case.
Got it. And so in your brain, I mean, this doesn't necessarily have the publishing history of something like Transformers or G.I. Joe or, cartoons like that. I mean, even I guess Thundercats has a new run that's coming out. Those are the shows that I kind of grew up with and stuff like that. Why do you think that is, as far as King Arthur? Why did the 41 Entertainment, why is this the first time? I mean, something almost 30 years later, why now? What is it that got them, was it just Mad Cave coming, getting the rights, or what are your thoughts on that?
I can't speak to all the in and outs for Mad Cave. I mean, I know that Lauren was a big fan of Princess Guinevere and the Jewel Riders.
Got it.
So that certainly was part of it. However, I do think part of the appeal here is, number one, there isn't a lot of other media on King Arthur and the Knights of Justice. There was the two seasons. There was an action figure line. There was the SNES video games. So there was a point where, so there was a point where it was like, oh, there's a lot going on here. It's been 30 years.
Yeah.
And I think another element here that really adds to it, like if I can't speak to this being the exact case, but if I were putting myself in the shoes of the licensor, I would be like, you know, we've got this property. King Arthur has, like, the idea of, like, Arthurian myth has a built-in audience.
Yeah.
So there will be people who pick this up having no idea that there was previous media about this, but they're just like, oh, King Arthur, you know, high fantasy sort of stuff. That sounds great. And that fantasy is enjoying some popularity. I mean, the increased popularity of things like Dungeons and Dragons and some other things, it seems like this would be a good time to do it.
Sure.
So with all those factors in there, I think, yeah, I mean, if you're the license holder of a property like this, like, this is the time to put it out there again.
Absolutely. Well, Joe Corallo, right? Got it right?
Correct.
Corallo, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate your time. I mean, and I enjoyed this. I enjoyed learning about a new cartoon show that I, unfortunately, not to offend anybody out there, I didn't know existed until now and have actually enjoyed watching on YouTube. So, like, I will try and pick it up on Tubi. Joe, where can people find you online? Like, are you on the socials? Do you have your own website? Like, are we still on the dreaded Twix? Like, where can people locate your work?
I mean, I am on Twitter and Blue Sky at Joe Corallo. So that's JoeCorallo. Mm-hmm. And on Instagram at Corallo Joe. I have more or less a portfolio site if people want to check it out, where it's just, you know, joecorallo.card, the CARRD.CO. So that's just, you know, it's a portfolio site. So, you know, sort of tells you things I've done or I'm actively, you know, doing, and has, you know, links to a bunch of the works I already have out, or, you know, some pre-order links. So.
Gotcha. Well, I very much enjoyed this. I really enjoyed reading it. I like what you did with the property. Again, I was only kind of comparing it to the first episode or so, but I was like, oh, there were some nice, like, little updates and changes that I didn't see in the first episode, where I was like, oh, okay, like, he took time and fleshed this out and, you know, made it a little bit more expansive than the universe that it was already in. So, like, congratulations.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Again, it's Joe Corallo. The book is called King Arthur and the Knights of Justice, out by Mad Cave Studios. And it's the Maverick imprint, which, can you remind me what the Maverick imprint is? Is it more the youth-oriented imprint through Mad Cave?
Yeah. Maverick is the you know, YA, OGN sort of driven imprint. They're also the ones putting out Princess Guinevere and the Jewel Riders. If you're interested in this stuff too, they also did In the Shadow of the Throne, which was also Gaia Cardinelli doing the art, which is another sort of YA fantasy, if people want to check that out as well.
Oh, cool. Well, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciated it. Love Mad Cave stuff. And this was a really enjoyable read. And will be a great, you know, trip down nostalgic lane if you enjoyed the show, which I can imagine, you know, there's people out there, just because I didn't know about it. I'm a dumb old guy. But thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Cool. Well, this has been another episode of the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. My name is Christian Horn. You can check us out on parttimefanboy.com. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. We are still on Facebook. We are still on Instagram. We are no longer on the dreaded Twix. Thank you for listening. Please go check out King Arthur and the Knights of Justice when it drops later this month. And we will be back soon with another episode. Bye.
Part-time.